AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm sitting here crammed at a table in person with David Canfield.
Hello. Welcome to my apartment.
David, we are together in person, which is very unusual because I'm in Los Angeles for our live podcast, which is happening tonight as you listen to this. If you're hearing it on Tuesday, we're very excited about it. But first, we have two interviews we want to share as Oscar voting wraps up. And first, we're going to hear your conversation with our table mate from the Critics' Choice Awards on Sunday night, Julianne Moore.
I had a very busy few days of running into Julianne Moore, which is not a brag by any means, but she's been around, and so have I. And so that's kind of where we start off the conversation is we had recorded just after the AFI Awards, where May December was honored. And this is the first time in a while she's gotten to make the rounds with a Todd Haynes movie, one she very clearly loves.
Well, and something you were saying to me last night that I noticed, she was sitting next to Charles Melton at our table for May-December, and she seems not quite protective over him, but kind of like, look, I've been down this road before. He's new to this. She seems to have a really interesting relationship with her co-star here, and I think you guys talked about this in this interview.
Yeah, we talked about exactly that. She mentioned giving him some advice in terms of how to navigate this whole circuit, and also kind of being in awe of him a little bit at how he's handled it, especially given that they were really thrown in mid-season after the strike. They started doing panels immediately. I met them as a group pretty quickly after it ended. And I think for her, being a part of a film with Todd Haynes, you know, her longtime collaborator, and kind of having the combination of that with this really exciting new talent has been special for her.
I think we should also say that, you know, Charles Melton has got a lot of the attention around May December for very good reason, but she is so great in this movie in such a hard role, which again, she's worked with Todd Haynes a lot. She's done it a lot for him. It doesn't come as a surprise, but it's still, I feel like we're taking her for granted in some ways. And I'm glad this interview can maybe start making up for that.
Yeah, this is the goal. She deserves it. She's wonderful in the movie. And yeah, we definitely get into the trickier aspects of that role, which continue to be tricky as people talk about it, as some inspirations from the movie have spoken out against it, and things of that nature.
Well, I'm excited to hear it. Let's hear your conversation with the star of May December, Julianne Moore.
Well, Julianne Moore, thanks so much for being here. You and I saw each other just hours ago
because that's right.
At the AFI Awards, it is that time of year.
Yep.
But I've been seeing you making the rounds with this film in a way where, you know, it happens with films that are getting embraced to a degree, and that's always nice. So I'm curious, just so far, these last few months, how you've experienced traveling with this movie, a movie where you all seem very tightly knit on this crew.
We are. I have to say, one of the things that's been so really wonderful about this project is how close we have been from the very beginning. It was a group of people that really hit it off right away. I mean, this is my fifth movie with Todd, my seventh movie with Killer Film. Yep. So obviously I've worked with them for a long time and had a very fruitful collaboration. but this is my first time working with Natalie, who has just completely, who's somebody I always admired, both personally and professionally, and she's really superseded all of my expectations. She's just such a wonderful, wonderful actor and a great human being. So it just sort of clicked. And Charles, who kind of came into this, you know, without any of us knowing him or even his work, really is also, as well as being supremely talented and really a revelation in this part, such a lovely person. So the nice thing has been that this is a movie that we all really care about, but we get along, and it's nice to have a little crowd to hang around with.
Yeah. First of all, Charles is brilliant in the movie, we must say. Yeah. We had him on the show a few months ago.
Good.
I'm really interested in the dynamic between the three of you at events like these. I'm curious if there's been any kind of mentorship and just what it is to walk into these rooms and be with, you know, these incredible groups of people, or just sort of initiating him in some way.
Well, I think we have a tremendous amount of camaraderie, I think, among all of us, and particularly among the three actors. And we've leaned into each other really heavily, just in terms of keeping each other company and, you know, just being together, offering friendship and support. And for Charles, I think that Natalie and I have been able to offer him some advice. I hope we have anyway. I mean, really, primarily, the advice is to enjoy it. And also to really just enjoy meeting these, you know, tremendous people that you're going to meet on the circuit. There were so many great films this year and so many great performances. And I think it's nice to, I don't know, it's nice to put a person behind that performance, right? You mm-hmm. know, so that's what we all get to do. It's been really nice.
Yeah. You mentioned your history with both Todd and Killer Films, and one narrative that has emerged this season has been perhaps the underappreciation, maybe by the Academy, of Christine Vachon, the producer of Killer Films, and Todd Haynes, the director, who's never been nominated for directing. Right. I'm curious from your perspective, as someone who's worked on these films over the years, and these are really daring films, films that have lasted, why you think that maybe there is a moment now of looking at this body of work that these collaborators of yours over decades have created in a different way?
I don't know, but I'm glad about it. I mean, I'm overjoyed because I do think that the work that they have done over these last three decades has been, you know, really underappreciated. It's I think they're extraordinary iconoclastic artists, you know, Todd and Christine. And I think that they have always pursued what is interesting to them artistically. They don't really look at a project as something that's going to be, you know, they're not looking to make $1 million, you know, millions of dollars making a movie. They really just want to kind of find a way to tell the stories that they want to tell. And like I said, I've been the beneficiary of that because I get to be in these amazing stories with them. I think that they're such an interesting pair, too, when you think that mm-hmm. they both came out of school at the same time, and they both had these kind of interesting, compelling artistic desires, and they've continued to follow them and to produce this remarkable work. And done it with, you know, Christine's always very smart because she understands what it takes to produce a film, right? She understands the commercial pressures, but she doesn't bow to this idea of profitability above all else. Mm-hmm. You know, she really works with a filmmaker to help them achieve their vision.
Yeah. You, I believe, met Todd auditioning for Safe, your first movie together. Can you take me back to that moment and really how he initially struck you, how Christine initially struck you? They were coming out of this queer cinema movement and really particular cinema scene, and this was obviously a big step forward for both of them.
Yeah, oh my God, and we were all so young. I mean, we sort of make jokes about it now. We look back, you know, all of us sort of acting like we knew what we were doing, but we were very, very
based
new.
Based on the film you did, it is a brilliant movie.
But I received the screenplay. I was actually working on a movie in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with Peter Falk, Ellen Burstyn, who was here today.
She was honored today at AFI.
Uh-huh, that's right, and D.B. Sweeney. Mm. And it was like a family movie. And I received the script, and I'd never read anything like it in my life. I was so utterly compelled by it. It was so, so rigorous and so specific. And I felt like, well, I couldn't believe it was coming my way. And then I had an opportunity to audition for it. I was like, why isn't this cast? This should be cast with someone. And I flew home to New York to audition. And I was really sort of, I felt like it was very clear that what I saw on the page, I really understood. But I also knew that if I was misinterpreting that, then I wasn't right for this particular filmmaker. Mm. You know, so I was really nervous, and it was a kind of a hot summer day. And I remember I wanted to look kind of blank. So I wore like a white t-shirt and white jeans. I tied my hair back and I went in, and, you know, there was Todd and there was Christine. And it was all very, it was an office room with like lots of filing cabinets and all this clutter everywhere. And Todd and I really didn't speak. You know, he's super, super friendly, but we didn't have a long conversation. And he had been told, unbeknownst to me, that I wouldn't read, is so crazy. I know. So somebody had told him I wouldn't read. And we started talking, and I said, do you want me to read this? And he was like, yeah. So like, I read one scene and he was like, okay. I said, do you want me to read another one? And I read that, and he said, okay. And I said, you want me to read another one? He said, okay. And I read a third one. And then he said, okay. I said, okay, bye. And that was it. And Todd said later that he and Christine looked at each other and said, that was Carol White, which was kind of, I mean, for me, one of the most wonderful moments of my career, honestly, that somehow I was able to interpret what I read, what he wrote, what I saw on the page. And I think that the nature of our collaboration has been that we have a similar sensibility. We are kind of, I don't know, I think, you know, we're the same age. We, I think, grew up with the same kind of genres influencing us. Mm-hmm. But for one reason or another, it really has been a thing where we can see each other.
Mm. Has his style as a director changed at all from your perspective? And since that first movie, taking May December as a comparison point, how have you seen him evolve, let's say?
I want to say he was fully formed. I mean, I really
fair
do.
Enough.
Because the thing about Todd is that he does so much work, so much preparation. He does a tremendous amount of research, and certainly when he's written a screenplay himself, he's done all of that work on it. But just in terms of how he frames something, how he, you know, he storyboards everything himself. I feel like I can look at a shot. I can, you know, look through the lens and sort of understand his storytelling by the way he frames something. He's really, really specific. He's specific in his camera moves and his choices and his editing choices and his musical choices and his in tone. You know, that stuff was all present, you know, when we made Safe, and also, of course, very present when we made May December. As an actor, he gives me so much scaffolding for my performance. Mm-hmm. I sort of understand the world that he's contained me in. And so within all of that, because I know how he's telling that story, I have incredible freedom. It's like, yeah, I don't know. It just makes me, his efforts are so tremendous. He's so incredibly thorough. His knowledge of cinema is formidable, but it's matched, you know, really only by his empathy for human beings, for what it means to be human and to be in these kind of sometimes heartbreaking human scenarios we find ourselves in. Mm.
Every time I interview him, I feel like I get a masterclass in cinema and cinema history.
Yeah.
I'm curious if he's given you any of that, like what he's introduced you to in terms of filmmakers. And some of his references are, you know, pretty down the middle, but some are quite obscure. And I remember one interview I came out and I was like, what is this movie he's talking about?
You know what he said the other day? We were doing a Q&A, and somebody asked me about judging a character or not judging a character. And is it important that an actor not judge their character? Mm-hmm. And I said, hell no. I can judge them. I mean, like, I judge my character. I mean, me personally, Julie, I can look at my character in May December, and I have lots of judgments about it. You know, I'm like, I don't need to tell myself a story that what she did was right or something. You know, I have a completely different opinion. And when I said that, Todd said, and I wish I could remember the word, he came up with a German word, which means exactly that. That it was, it's something that Douglas Sirk said about, like, that in order to create, you know, great art, you don't have to kind of merge yourself with the story. You can have some distance. And that doesn't mean that it's not affecting and emotional, but you don't have to be aligned with it. And I was like, no, I wish I could remember the German word. Because I was like, Todd, what's that? Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. I have to imagine that happens with him fairly often, some version of that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He's pretty, he's very smart. But like I said, he also doesn't, you know, he's, there's something so wonderful about his, like I said, his empathy for people and how he sees people who have been otherized in one way or another, been kind of in a place where they're subjugated. You know, it's like he sees that and he's able to tell their stories, I think, really eloquently.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So you saying you have judgments about this character, I would imagine everyone watching this movie does. I know the word you've used a lot in describing, you know, the sort of impetus for telling the story or sort of this point in her life is transgression, and that she transgressed in a really public way, a really dramatic way. Is there a way in which you think about transgression as an actor? You go into a role like that and given that you do come in with those kinds of judgments, it changes the way you approach them at all? I'm just curious.
No, because I think that you can hold two ideas at the same time. Do you know? I think you can approach a character or a story holistically, that you can say, like, I'm, you know, how do I tell this story and how do I represent this person from her point of view, which is what I'm doing as an actor. But at the same time I'm doing that, I'm also myself with my own thoughts and actions and whatever, and I'm separate from it. I always think that one of the things that's really important with acting, and I think for me, film acting in particular, it's something that engages you emotionally as a person, because you kind of have to let these, you're literally a conduit for these feelings and these words. But your intellect is there, and that intellect sees the camera, and they see all the other people, and they see the lights, and they hear the traffic, and they, you know, and so it's like that kind of, that's what's so exciting about filmmaking, that there is this parallel kind of experience that you're having as a human being, where you're able to hold this kind of this emotional experience, you know, within your intellectual experience, which is registering the fact that you're creating something.
Am I right that this came together fairly quickly? There wasn't much time for rehearsal or anything like that?
No, we didn't have time, we didn't have money, we didn't have, you know, we had lots and lots of scheduling issues. It was sort of about when Todd was going to be available, when Natalie was going to be available, when I was going to be available. And suddenly there was this weird little window in October. And that's kind of why we ended up in Savannah too, because it needed to be, you know, warm weather. And the script had initially been set in Camden, Maine, and it was not going to be warm there.
Right.
yeah, we were just trying to make accommodations so that it would all work. And there was even a point, you know, because Natalie has to, you know, slowly begin to copy my mannerisms.
Yes.
Where we worried schedule-wise that they would have, Todd was like, we might have to start with Natalie before you get there, because I was supposed to have another job right in front of it. And he was like, what are we going to do? Do you want to just like get on a Zoom with her and like figure it out? And I was like, oh my God. Happily, that movie moved. And then we were able to start all together, but with really no rehearsal at all.
It's a nice segue into my next question though, which is how did you observe her beginning to copy you? Like, were there things you were noticing, particularly in the beginning stages, and you are making significant choices here where you were like, oh, she's picking up on this, she's picking up on that.
Absolutely. Well, Todd and I spoke about what would characterize Gracie. You know, I mean, so all the work that I do as an actor, I think about that character's physicality. I think about their, how their voice is. Those are all the choices that you make when you're working on something.
Yep.
But this was even kind of more urgent, because I needed to establish these characteristics and characteristics that were interesting enough that we could, that Natalie would have something to actually copy. So in thinking about Gracie and her, she has this, like I said, going back to this transgression, which she kind of describes as like a great romance.
Yes.
That she has, she has met this person and they rescued her. You know, she's the princess that's been rescued by a prince. But of course, the reality is that he's a boy, and she has to kind of elevate this boy to being a man. And she subjugates herself to that narrative. You know, she's the princess, and he's taking care of her. So there's a childlike quality with Gracie that remains, and of course, a hyper femininity to this princess kind of thing. So there were gestures and things that I kind of created a way of moving, and then I thought about, I was kind of thinking about childlike speech and of course something that we associate with kids is like maybe like a lisp.
Yes.
And Todd and I talked about that. And so those were the things that I kind of came in with and worked with. And then Natalie, brilliantly, like I said, in real time, of course I can see what she's doing. You know, of course I can, because she's, I'm sitting in a chair with my legs crossed and my arms crossed, and Natalie's sitting in a chair the exact same way. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of copying my cadence. But what she's doing, which is because, Gracie is desperate for Elizabeth's approbation. She wants Elizabeth to tell the story the way Gracie wants it told. And so what Natalie is doing by copying her and flattering her at Gracie's most composed, most feminine, most presentational, most performative, is playing right into what Gracie wants. So Natalie was able to do that, make me feel good as a character. And also it was a lot of fun as an actor. Mm-hmm. Like I really, really enjoyed it. So she was able to do that. And then also I think kind of wonderfully and devilishly that when I actually saw the film, you realize kind of the finer things that she's copying, the things that Gracie, the character, wouldn't want to see. Anyway, so it was intensely pleasurable to work with Natalie in this way. And I think that we kind of, it was just like, it was a wonderful partnership where we kind of built these women and their behavior together.
It's also so on the fly, as you're describing, because you didn't have that prep time. I wonder if that was maybe, in hindsight, a kind of a blessing.
You know, listen.
Maybe not.
As they say in preschool, you get what you get and you don't get upset. You know, it's like you don't know. You don't know what would be better or not. But that's what we had. But I do think that people on this movie were incredibly collaborative and kind and open, and were people who take the work very seriously. They don't take themselves personally very seriously. So it felt easy. It felt great to do it together.
Yes. Well, one reason I had that thought is one of the beauties of award season is you have lots of people coming together, and All of Your Kids Are All Right cast has been also out
amazing.
There.
Amazing.
And I interviewed Annette Bening, and we had talked about the fact that you really had no rehearsal for that movie.
Right.
And that's another case where I look at the dynamic between, very different dynamic between two women in that movie. But again, I mean, it is one of my favorite movies, and there's an incredible richness between the three of you, but especially the two of you in that relationship.
Thank you. I think, also that's the nature of independent film. You don't have enough money, so you don't have enough time. You know, that's really what money equals, time. And like I said, we would all like more time, but we don't always get it. But what we get is great material. And so that just lifts everything up.
Yeah. So when you come into a movie like May December, and you know that, you know, you've been in this industry for a bit, you know what is required, especially of a character like this. Are there things, say, in, you know, the costuming and in the technical aspects of it that you know you're going to need, you're going to need to maybe improvise with a little bit versus on a bigger budget film?
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah. I mean, I think that I think, you know, costumes are incredibly important, and hairstyles and wigs and, you know, color of the wigs and all of those things were things that we considered in this. These were, you know, everything that a person wears, how they do their makeup, you know, how mm-hmm. they move. All of those things are signifiers to the world about how we want to be seen. Consciously or unconsciously. And so you take all of those things into, mm-hmm. you know, into consideration when you're working on it. And with our wonderful costume designer, April Napier, there was one specific item that I wanted. There's a dress that became wildly popular during the pandemic called the nap dress. And it's a dress that's very, very feminine. It's made in lots of different fabrics and has kind of smocking on it and these like little ruffles on the shoulders. And it's so soft, the idea is that you could mm-hmm. sleep in it, you know, but it's very feminine and it's a little infantilizing. Mm. And I was telling April about this dress and we were placing the dress and I said, I want to make sure that it's in the scene where I'm on the bed when I'm crying, yes. you know, when Charles comes in. And in order to do that, it has to be in the makeup scene with Natalie before. Like, so that dress ends up playing in like three scenes in a row. And we placed very specifically because of the physical actions of lying in the bed and moving around and also being in that scene with Natalie and having those like little ruffles kind of being really prevalent, you mm-hmm. know, while I'm doing her makeup.
Well, I do want to move to the genre element of this movie. It was categorized at the Golden Globes as a comedy, which sparked some conversation, let's say. And there's been a larger conversation about, you know, how funny is the movie? How funny should the movie be considered? I'm wondering, on the set, are there moments that feel funny to you? I know you've said that there are moments that in the film play as funny and should. Yeah. I'm wondering how it felt to play them, though.
Well, you know, Charles has said this, that, you know, even I think when you're playing maybe an out-and-out comedy, you can't, you know, the stakes are high,
yep.
you know, when people are communicating to one another, you know, you have to make sure the stakes are high. That's the way in comedy you ensure that it will be funny, right? Mm-hmm. Is to make people mean it. I think we were not playing it with an eye toward that. There are some lines like, one of my favorites is, you try going through life without a scale, see how that goes,
yes.
which I think is a really funny line.
Me too.
But of course, she's not intending it yep. that way. She's dead serious mm-hmm. about it, you know, about like the cultural imprisonment of weight and women, you know. So, but it ends up being a funny line.
She is devastated at the thought that there may not be enough hot dogs. She takes it very seriously.
Right. Well, with that, you know, that line is also, of course, framed by the music. You
yes.
know, so would that be funny? You know, what Todd's doing is like he's saying, oh, wait, she seems to be saying something innocuous, but I'm going to put this kind of big piece of music on it.
Yeah.
So the audience knows right away, what? You know, so that juxtaposition in and of itself is funny. You
yeah.
know, it's jarring, this idea of like a situation about how much food you're going to have shouldn't be that dramatic. But it is because of the music.
Yes, that's exactly what I asked. I feel like Todd, as he's one to do, he amps it up once you guys are
yeah.
done.
yeah.
The element, this is obviously an original story, original script.
Right.
The overlap with the Mary Kay Letourneau case is something that has been interesting to me. There was a clip going around of her in an interview with dialogue that is actually in the film. It's the who was the boss scene. It's just applied mm-hmm. in a different context. I know you've talked a lot about this being original and not based on that, but I am wondering
right.
if there were elements of that story that you did pay attention to in the creation of this character.
Listen, you know, Sammy Virch has spoken about this. This was very much, you know, that Letourneau case was very much an inspiration for this screenplay. You know, Sammy grew up in the 90s, sort of the heyday of tabloid culture, when you had Monica Lewinsky, Mary Kay Letourneau, and O.J. Simpson, and this kind of the storytelling, this kind of rabid, dramatic, you know, what's going to happen next kind of story. So I think she was responding to that. So yeah, I mean, we did use it as inspiration, but I think we had to be very clear that this was, this is a fictional creation of something that was similar. But I wouldn't dare say that this is based on those people. I mean, it's just not. It's like we, I think we all respond. I think in art, you know, you see these, you know, Tom Wolfe was somebody who was famous for writing fictional stories that sometimes felt reminiscent of something that had happened in the news, you know, or in society culture or something. So I think that there is a tradition of people being inspired by stuff that, you know, that's happened in real life. But no, and also we don't know. I mean, I think what's interesting about this story is that Todd is playing with, you know, narrative. Who gets to tell the story? How has a story been told? Who told it? Why? Is it the truth? Who knows the truth? Nobody knows the truth of what happened in anything except the people that were there. But what's interesting about tabloids is that people just keep putting a lens on it and telling a story in order to generate money.
Given the intensity of this role. I mentioned the comedy, but your character especially has really intensely emotional scenes. How easy is it for you to kind of turn that on and off? You are kind of an iconic crier of the screen, and this film is no exception. But I'm wondering at this point, having done that a few times, and this is a very different kind of character, like what it looks like for you between takes.
You know, it's so interesting. I mean, obviously, I don't know, maybe some actors don't have anxiety about this, but whenever I feel like I have to produce something that's emotional, I always have some anxiety about it. I'm like, oh, you know, is it going to, will I be able to deliver that? Can I deliver that at that moment? Is it going to work? But the thing that I've learned after all of these years that what really works for me is being relaxed. Is being in a situation where I feel comfortable with my surroundings. I feel comfortable with the choices that I've made. I trust my collaborators, and I'm able to feel kind of free enough to breathe and, you know, let it happen. Mm-hmm. That sounds very actory, but there's something, you know, you have to do. I always say you need to do the work. You need to do the preparation. In film, in order to let the emotion happen to you on camera, because that's the beauty of film work, is that it could even happen to you for the first time, but you want to make sure it happens on camera because you want the camera to capture it, you know? And that's what's kind of great. Sometimes you don't even know. When we did the scene with the cake thing, I just had a sense that she was going to cry much more than was on the page. Because there was an earlier scene where she cries, and I wanted that one to be smaller, and this one I wanted to be kind of like huge, because it's the middle of the movie. And I think what Gracie is feeling is that, like I said, there's the narrative that Gracie has told the world on one level, and then at the bottom there's this transgression, and in between there's all of this emotion and volatility and guilt and shame. And so the composure, when you see, you know, Gracie in her very public moments, and she's seemingly composed, that volatility, that emotional quality is always there. That always exists. So here's somebody who's living with this kind of like a vibration of emotion constantly. So it's like I wanted that, you know, in her private moments, that's when it just kind of explodes. So it ended up being very hysterical. Because that's also, you know, that's what Joe has been dealing with his entire life. It's like, how does he care? He's having to care for this adult woman who's got this kind of huge amount of emotion and need. She's very needy.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're going to hear the conversation I had with Jada Yuan, who is not an actor or a Hollywood person at all, but a journalist just like us. She works at the Washington Post. And she's also the author of Unleashing Oppenheimer, which is the official behind-the-scenes book for the film Oppenheimer. Jada has a really interesting personal connection to Oppenheimer. Her grandmother worked on the Manhattan Project. She grew up in Los Alamos, kind of surrounded by the legacy of all the work that you see in the film. And she had a really interesting personal connection to the story before diving into it for writing this book. And one of the things that I thought was fascinating reading the book and talking to Jada about it was talking about the visual effects in Oppenheimer, which did not make the Oscar shortlist for visual effects, which kind of blows my mind, but won the visual effects award at the Critics' Choice Awards that we were at, David, which I thought was a really worthy way of recognizing part of the film that feels like it's been under-discussed, even though we've been talking about it for so many months.
Yeah, I think it's a good movie to finish the first round of voting with because it is the front runner and it's winning in a lot of areas. And to your point, it seems to reveal itself in a new way in terms of what makes it so exceptional with every passing award.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a great time talking to Jada about it. Her book also is a great way to get into it. So let's hear my conversation with the author of Unleashing Oppenheimer, Jada Yuan. So I'm so happy to welcome Jada Yuan, a fellow journalist and writer and Oscar obsessive and just like friend in all things film festivals. And now a guest on our podcast because you're a published author. What an exciting circumstance.
It's so exciting. I'm so glad to be on this. And I listen to you all the time.
Oh, so. Thank you. Yeah, I feel like we all learn from each other over the course of these many award seasons. But you're in a funny position this year because you are the author of the book Unleashing Oppenheimer, which you wrote as the film was being made. It's this really incredible, extensive look behind the scenes of the movie that, you know, I'm not biased. I can say I think it's going to win Best Picture. But it's a funny way to have a window into this season, right? Like you follow all these movies all the time, but you've got this one like really in your back pocket. What's that been like?
It's been thrilling. I have never kind of been on a ride like this with a movie. I cover them from afar. Or, you know, I've gone to a lot of those awards dinners where you're sort of wandering around and then you become best friends with, you know, the people, just the people who you see all the time. I remember one year when I like hung out with Ezra Edelman just all the time because that was, you know, you're there and you keep seeing the same people over and over again. But this just, it feels different because I feel like I have some sort of stake in this movie. I wrote the making of book of this movie, but it also, I grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and my grandmother, Chen Sheng-Wu, was a nuclear physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project and knew Oppenheimer. And so it just feels very special that Christopher Nolan let me write a book about the making of the movie.
Yeah, I love in the foreword how you talk about what happened before Christopher Nolan asked you to write this book, that you kind of knew that they were filming near your hometown. You're like, I'm just going to go home. I'm going to sneak around and see what's going on, which is so funny to imagine in the background of the scenes of this movie, which is so meticulously made. So you don't ever imagine that there's a bunch of people in the 21st century standing in the background. But what was that like when you're just kind of like looking around a building to see what Cillian Murphy's up to?
Well, yeah, I mean, Christopher Nolan's sets, I think, normally are very tightly controlled. I'm sure people in Chicago were like, what's happening? They're blowing up a chocolate factory or whatever, whenever he did.
Oh, like on The Dark Knight, yeah.
Yeah, on The Dark Knight. Yeah, so I'm sure there are moments that people have witnessed things that have happened in his movie, but Los Alamos is an incredibly small town, and word had just sort of spread that. And people weren't that great about keeping secrets about where he was shooting. And so I was able to find out through repertorial ways when they were shooting outside. And they were shooting outside Fuller Lodge, which is the big blog building you see in the movie, which is where we had a graduation party. I think... I have trouble remembering like my childhood that well, but I think my mom probably did jazzercise across the street.
And you've seen in the movie for like the Christmas party scene and a couple of other moments in the movie, the real one.
Yeah, the Christmas party scene takes place inside the lodge, so I didn't get to witness that. But Killian does, as Oppenheimer, does a speech outside with all these flags at the end of the Manhattan Project, and that's outside Furlor Lodge, so I witnessed that. And Christopher Nolan also shot outside Oppenheimer's real house, which is just on a street that you go to as a kid called Bathtub Row, which is the real Bathtub Row where the scientists all live. It was all the senior scientists lived in this area where there had been set up houses. Like Los Alamos was a boys' school that got taken over by the Manhattan Project. And so this is where the teachers lived. And it was called Bathtub Row because they were the only houses with bathtubs. No kitchens, as Emily Blunt says in the movie. And anyway, so you know where Bathtub Row is, and I sort of snuck over there and was watching them film a laundry scene, which is literally like I'm just watching the bottom of Emily Blunt's legs as she hangs up a sheet, which is a major moment in the movie.
That's kind of the dark secret of film sets, though, right? Is if you're standing on a film set watching, you're watching just this like tiny, insignificant movement. And like for the people who are making it, they know what's going on. And you're just like, okay, I guess they're standing there again. And go back to one.
Yeah, and you can't hear anything. So I was with a bunch of nurses from a dentist's office who were in their scrubs on their lunch break. And I had sent a letter over to Christopher Nolan and Emma Thomas, who's his producer and his wife, that was like, hey, I have all these connections and I'm also a culture writer. And can I do an article for the Washington Post for you? And also, you know, I don't know if you have a making of book, just let me know.
Do they I guess they would usually have them, right? Like many huge movies have making of books like this, maybe not as extensive as what you've done.
Yeah, mine is the longest they've ever published.
Congratulations.
Yeah, Christopher Nolan has done three. So they started with Dunkirk, and Interstellar, and then Tenet. But they're all usually done by people who write making of books for a living. And I was someone who had never even written a book at all. And they liked my connection, and that's how I got involved. But I didn't find out until much later after they finished filming in my hometown. And so it was like a lot of sneaking around, and sort of I met a bunch of the local crew. And we had beers, in this brewery that's called Bathtub Row Brewing. So it's named after Oppenheimer also. There's a mural of Oppenheimer in the back, and the town is really into it. I went back for when the movie premiered, and they had like a vintage army truck outside.
Cool.
And they had made up the front of the movie theater to look like the guard gate for the Manhattan Project.
Cool.
That you'll see in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah, because you mentioned in the book that when you grow up in New Mexico and Los Alamos specifically, you never hear of Oppenheimer as anything other than a hero. And it's not like the movie shows him as unheroic, but it's complicated. And I think for a lot of us who grew up as part of the Cold War, we've kind of learned to think about it in a different way. Has it been received that way in Los Alamos? Is there a sense of being like, oh, no, you're talking about why it's bad? Or are they kind of prepared for that level of nuance?
That's difficult. I think that the town is still proud of his accomplishments, and it exists because he went there.
Yeah.
It exists because he, as a child, went to Los Alamos and loved it so much. And then he said he ruined it and he felt really bad about it. But so I think it's less complicated for the people who live there. I think that they're proud of the history. I think, I lived there until I was 6 years old, and I grew up in the Valley, and my dad doesn't really talk about politics. He's also a nuclear physicist, but I think that we all have a more complicated relationship with that legacy. And sort of wondering, you know, what would have happened if we hadn't done this thing that killed hundreds of thousands of people. It was really horrible.
Yeah, but I also think the film gives you a lot to be proud of if you live in Los Alamos, right? Like it does such an incredible job of celebrating this massive accomplishment while also reckoning with what came out of it, and that both of those things can be true, which I think is what makes it really special.
Yeah, and I think that the film does a good job of of letting you know their mindset back in the time, which mm-hmm. was that someone was going to use this technology and they were really hoping it wasn't Hitler first.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
So for the writing of the book process, you know, I'm reading through it and the number of people that you're talking to and the granular detail you get to get into, you know, we do interviews with people about films all the time, but you have to fill a word space or you have to have a narrative to it. And you really get to be like, well, this week they were filming at UCLA and then the following week he got a haircut. Like, it's such a fun, satisfying deep dive. And I wonder how that felt for you having written much shorter things to get to just like go all the way in on all of it.
I mean, it was really fun because I could call up Ludwig Göransson, who's, you know, an Oscar-winning composer, in the middle of the night and just be like, hey, are you available? I have 10 other questions about how you make music. So that was fun. I mean, there were a lot of holes that I needed to fill in. And I think the writing process was interesting because Chris is a pretty busy guy. And so I actually had to talk to everyone before I talked to Chris, and Chris was the most important one. So yeah. I was in some ways filling in word gaps. Like, we would have a great quote from somebody that I had like put it into the placeholder, and then I would try to get Chris to talk about the same thing, and then we would like swap out quotes. So it was just a different process to have to do it. But it was so much fun to learn how they made everything. I mean, I think some of my favorite parts were talking to the researcher, Lauren mm-hmm. Salazar. And I mean, she knew everything. She was one of my greatest sources. And she had binders and binders. I mean, they made binders of what each actual scientist or actual real life person, because everybody's real in this movie, looks like, and sort of what their characteristics were.
And what then, their parents looked like, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they made like very incredibly detailed binders for everyone. And so they were trying to cast off people who kind of looked like the real people. That was really incredible. I thought sort of the special effects, which I think are not going to get honored at the Oscars.
I don't think they made, did they make the short? I'm going to look that up.
They didn't make the short list.
Yeah.
They didn't make the short list, which Ferrari also didn't make the short list. And I'm just a little annoyed with the sort of idea that if you create something on a computer, it's better than if you painstakingly create something in real life in camera.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a shot in your book of one of the shots of Oppenheimer in bed with like the swirling lights in front of him. And like just the idea that that existed in reality. I just hadn't thought about it. And I knew that they were all practical, but I don't think I knew it until I saw that picture. It really blew my mind.
Yeah, I mean, and it was incredible to hear how they were doing it, which was that, they started months ahead of production and were sort of, it's just Andrew Jackson and Scott Fisher. Andrew Jackson, who does visual effects, and Scott Fisher does special effects. So he was more in charge of the blowing up of the bomb. But they were just doing experiments and like burning weird metals like thermite and just putting things on like strings with beads on a stick that had a motor in it and then like swirling it in front of the camera and seeing what that happened. It just sounded really fun, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, the way that they talk about the special effects in it, and then the way that then I think John Papsidera is the one who says that like Nolan thinks of the actors as a special effect too. And then you kind of go through like just the amount of granular levels that you get into on that. I've never interviewed a casting director in depth like that. What do you learn from John Papsidera in those conversations?
Well, I mean, he knows Chris incredibly well since he worked on every movie except for, I think, from Memento. And then he didn't work on Insomnia and then every other movie mm-hmm. after that. So just he knows every single person in Hollywood and their strengths. He's like, I think that this person would be great for this thing, and how about we, you know, cast Macon Blair, who is maybe known more as a director in this role, or, you know, somebody falls out and you're like, how about Jason Clarke?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love talking to him. He was really fun. But he's actually thinking not just about what a person looks like, but about essences and mm-hmm. also groupings of people. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they very meticulously cast like all the different terrible white guys on that panel to be like very different looking terrible white guys.
And like not all of them are even the ones that you necessarily, you know, there's Tony Goldwyn, but then there's like the ones who don't even have any lines, but they all have to kind of go in a mix, right?
Yeah, no, and they're all incredibly carefully selected so that that panel looks like in a particular way on screen. And he knows that the guy on the right-hand side of the screen is going to nod in a mm-hmm. particular way.
Yeah. And he also made it sound like Nolan watches a ton of stuff too. You know, obviously it's the casting director's job to know all this, but you know, he had a story about like meeting David Krumholtz on the set of Numbers. Krumholtz told me when I interviewed him, like he's paying attention in a way that is hard to imagine for someone who is as busy, like you say he is.
Well, I think that Chris consumes a lot of pop culture and a lot of art, and he takes notes in his head. I mean, that's how he met Ludwig Göransson, was that he knows Ryan Coogler, and Ryan Coogler invited him to a Black Panther screening, and he thought, oh, who did that music? And he just sort of kept it in his head. He's like, maybe I want to cast that guy sometime.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe I want to work with that guy sometime.
It's our job to keep track of what everyone's doing in the business, and it doesn't feel fair when people who are making movies are also doing it. Give us some space here.
Yeah, when they're the biggest people in the movie business.
Yeah, exactly.
Christopher Nolan, you have a lot of jobs.
Exactly. The other part of the book that was so eye-opening to me is Ruth DeJong. Is that how you say her name? DeJong? Mm-hmm. The production designer. Just talking about like what they had and what they didn't have. Like you think of this movie as being kind of like limitless in terms of what they're capable of. But she's like, we were running out of money and we had to build this thing small and we had to like improvise. Like I thought I knew a lot about how movies are made, but I was kind of astonished by what she had to scrap for to make possible for this movie.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, so what you're talking about is that they thought they had a $20 million to recreate 1940s Los Alamos on a mesa somewhere, and then it turned out that they had three.
Nothing, but still.
Not nothing. Definitely not nothing. But I found that really interesting because I think that, you know, my understanding was that Christopher Nolan gave Universal a number and was like, we're going to come in under this number. And if I come in under this number and I come under this time, which is like 1 minute less than 3 hours, like, like we, you know, he can sort of do this unfettered. And there's a great book by Tom Schoen called The Nolan Variations, which I don't know if you've read, but it sort of talks about his process throughout. It's sort of the most extensive interviews he's done. And I think that that was something that he learned was that if you can keep things tight and on a budget, then you actually have much more creative freedom than if you're someone who starts going over budget, then you start getting a lot more like oversight. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so with the Los Alamos set, it just sounded really funny. It was just that they're like, okay, so we can't shoot here and, you know, we can't do this location that you wanted. Sorry, we're going to have to like, you know, create Washington, D.C. in Santa Fe because we get better tax credits for actors' salaries and various other things. But they made a white model. Chris likes working with actual physical models rather than digital recreations of like what the set's going to look like. So they were building this model out of foam board and pencil and X-Acto knives and all this stuff. And then, you know, they got the news that they had to cut the budget by a significant amount and were just throwing buildings off of this model. And like one person referred to it as a graveyard of buildings that were under the table. They're like, okay, so I guess we don't need that building. We don't need that building. And then they had to sort of also discard walls and other things to just do a forced perspective so that it looks fine to the eye, but that they're not building floors and you just like open a door and you walk into a dirt room.
I think the part that blew my mind that I never would have thought of is the train that they built in like some basement somewhere, like on some tires, and like Nolan himself is like shaking the train box as they're filming. Like what a magic trick they pull off for things like that.
Yeah, that's the scene where I think David Krumholtz's Isidore Rabi is talking to Killian about them both being Jews from the other side of the park.
Tries to feed him an orange, very famously.
Very famously. Probably didn't. He didn't eat it, as
no,
I remember
of course not.
In the scene. Yeah. I think, did you, when you, I think it was in your Emily Blunt interview where she's like, they just lived on cigarettes and martinis. Yeah. That was.
Well, that's an American Prometheus too, right? Where it like kind of makes you want a martini, but also like worry about them and their.
Well, I mean, they just, he died quite young of terrible lung cancer. And I did learn that Oppenheimer, I mean, the props master, Guillaume Deloche, he had done a lot of research on Oppenheimer. And he said that his fingers were so yellow from smoking, like they just never unstained. They were always yellow. And then also he smoked like 200 cigarettes a day, like some insane number. And that he never even had to light a match ever because he just would just light a cigarette with another cigarette. But that was that was in the days.
Yep, that was the time. So for writing about movies you're going to do after this, like now that you have seen this much behind the curtain, like how has it changed the way you think about movies? Do you now just consider it a miracle that any movie is ever made? Because that's kind of how I feel reading your book.
It does feel like a miracle. I think I just have a much better understanding of what everybody's job on a film set is.
Yeah.
And how there is just this very intricate dance that all these people have to do, where if you don't get your job done over here, then the whole like tiny Jenga tower just falls apart.
Yeah.
I found it was really different. I wrote a piece about Ferrari and how they put the racing scenes together. And I felt like I had just a much better understanding of what everybody's job on a film set is.
Yeah.
Now I want to like spend more time on film sets. I'm like, how do we write about these movies and we don't spend enough time on the sets? I think I've also become friendlier with some actors, which I thought was not, you know, in the past I've kept like a really professional distance and I've spent more time with them and I'm like, wow, this is a really different personality type than in terms of like that I am sort of retreating and I, you know, like to write, I like to observe. And yeah, so I was really lucky that I threw this really spontaneous New York book launch at a friend's house. And I had met some of the actors. I met Krumholtz and Oli Haskivi on the strike line in the summer. And we had kept in touch. And I invited them to this thing, thinking they would never show up at my friend's house in Brooklyn. And they showed up. And they showed up. And they were willing to like talk to the crowd. And then my friend who writes at Page Six wanted to write about the thing. And I was so nervous about telling these guys. I was like, oh, my God.
Oh, like the media is here.
I mean, she wasn't even there. She just wanted to write about it afterwards. But I was like, you know, they came in good faith and they don't, you know, I don't want to blow up their spot that they came. And they were like, yeah, of course. which is just like, oh, yeah, like your job is putting yourself in front of cameras and making people happy and sort of sharing all of yourself. And it's not a problem for you whatsoever. Whereas like for me, just in my writing, getting to the point where I was like willing to like say, like put myself in first person sometimes in pieces. it was a big leap.
Well, it also feels like a lot of those guys are like, yeah, this is maybe the best movie I'll ever make. Like I may as well like be as visible for it as I can be as long as possible. Like I feel like I do the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And they're just utterly delighted to have done it. I mean, they're all just Nolan fanboys. And they have this Oppenheimer's group text, which is now famous, that Jack Quaid started because he got stranded in Los Alamos. He went to the grocery store and couldn't get an Uber back. And so had to steal a shopping cart and was like driving it along. And he started a text chain because he was like,
someone come pick me up.
Does anyone have a car?
So maybe by the end of this ride, they'll invite you onto the Oppenheimer's group text. You can only be so lucky.
Oh, I think that is a very long way off.
That does it for today's show. The next time you hear us, it will be our live show from Los Angeles with Lily Gladstone and Jacqueline West and Julie O'Keefe, the costume designers of Killers of the Flower Moon. We're really excited about it. We're excited for you to listen, even if you are not there in person. In the meantime, find us at Vanity Fair on social media at VF Awards Insider. I am at Katie Rich and David.
David Canfield, 97.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
From PRX.